l'histoire de Jesse James. Comment il a vécu? Comment il est mort? Ça vous a plu, hein? Vous en demandez encore? Eh bien, écoutez l'histoire de Bonnie and Clyde. Alors voilà, Clyde a une petite amie. Elle est belle et son prénom c'est...
Bonnie.
À eux deux, ils forment le gang Barrow. Leur nom...
Bonnie Parker.
Et Clyde Barrow.
Bonnie and Clyde. Bonnie and Clyde. Moi, lorsque j'ai connu Clyde autrefois, c'était un gars loyal, honnête et droit.
Il faut croire que c'est la société qui m'a définitivement abîmé.
Bonnie and Clyde.
Well, that was Bonnie and Clyde by Serge Gainsbourg. With a surprise guest appearance from Brigitte Bardot, that's her, and someone in the background with a bad case of whooping cough or house mite dust allergy. I don't know what, but I find the track endlessly exotic. I like a lot of French music, like Jake Thackeray, who I might have talked about. I'm at least as interested in what they're doing on the near continent as what they're doing over the pond. I find it impossibly exotic. And I've listened to a lot of French music, especially Léo Ferré, who doesn't get played nearly enough, but that maybe that's a little bit too esoteric. So we have Serge Gainsbourg has occasionally been fashionable. He was a big, big star, and we've always thought of him as a bit of... I think we've always thought of Serge Gainsbourg as a bit of a dirty dog, really. And he's come over here and in London expecting to be feted, and kind of nobody knew who he was, and I think he was vaguely hurt by that, because he was a great French record producer. He made wonderful records. I mean, that record is very well produced. Serge Gainsbourg was very, very well known in France in the 60s, and he came over here. And, you know, a few people knew who he was here in the industry, but I don't think the British public ever took him seriously, because the first thing he was known for here was the Je t'aime moi non plus with Jane Birkin, which got to the top of the charts here and was promptly banned, so... we weren't actually allowed to hear it. You did, you heard it wherever you went in pubs on jukeboxes, but you weren't allowed to hear it on the radio, and it was only an organ with a bit of, not even grunting and groaning, just sighing really, but that would have been seen as terribly risque. Serge Gainsbourg was regarded widely as quite an ugly man, and he kept scoring really beautiful women, one after another, and everyone... was rather mystified and hurt by it. Well, he's got this sort of ugly little French guy, and what's he got that I haven't got? You know, I'm a handsome pop star, and there's this ugly French guy. He was, you know, some people, from a certain angle, he would look very interesting and handsome with his Gallic clothes and his permanent, you know, disc blur in his mouth. A lot of English women would think, God, I fancy a bit of that. Of course they would, you know. What did Serge Gainsbourg have? He's a good record producer. He was sexy. At the time, what was beginning to happen in England then, apart from the Stones, was there was a lot of prog rock bands. And prog rock, after psychedelia, prog rock was a kind of... a bit more grown up. We've got a bit of a concept here, chaps. And so off they go with their moustaches and their long hair. They had these, all had Zapata moustaches and greatcoats, and they all stood meaningfully in fields, saying, we've got a concept album. And it was redolent, really, of their commuter fathers. Kind of Python-esque, four men with moustaches going off to work to do something sort of quite serious. Right, chaps, yes, we're into the third movement here. Can somebody bring the cows in, please? And it was like that, and so Serge Gainsbourg wasn't... He was still making pop. French pop's very strange and wonderful, I think. There's lots of it. The British do go round in circles when they're talking about love. I mean, especially since it was, you know, the last bit of psychedelia. Yeah, the French were just being French. Only the French can be French like that. You know, it's something vaguely rude. It's a kind of... You know, when you first go to Paris, or you ever see Paris, and you're in those side streets, those dark side streets with the balconies, and some woman comes to the window in a nightdress with a fag, and, you know, and she's smoking a cigarette, and you think, yeah, I'm definitely in France then. It's not very far away, but it's very foreign, isn't it? Even now. Now we're all supposed to be international and everything, and people go and break their arms snowboarding in Bulgaria. You... you know, routinely they do. I don't know, you walk down those streets, the noise is different. The noise of the street in France is different. And there is kind of a smell of bakeries and chocolate and, I don't know, it's just, you know, you and the sort of sound of people shouting, and even the car horns sound foreign, and the way they toot them. You know, if you go to a pub on a Friday night with a building chap having a pint of Stella, before the fighting starts, I mean, that's usually quite cheerful. As long as you're out by about 7:30, you're fine, you know. I suppose they did seem sexy and exotic. When I was 16, I had a French girlfriend. I mean, it was all very, very, all very innocent kind of thing. But she did. There was something about the way she smoked a cigarette and how she dressed and everything that was just a little bit different to English girls. But in 1967, my dad, we had been in Malaya, and I'd lived briefly in I don't know, Hertfordshire. And my dad got a posting to London. It's quite unusual. There are soldiers in London, but he was doing an office job. And we went to live in Putney, and I went to school there for a bit. And that was right at the beginning of the Summer of Love in 1967. I was 14, you know, it was just absolutely useless, really. I didn't know what was going on. I had short hair, you know, and I was learning a few chords on a guitar. And I mean, the idea that they put around now is that London was somehow full of hippies all having this massive loving. And it wasn't. There were probably about 100 people, and they all just hung around in a few clubs in the West End, and you never saw them. And if you did see anyone outside that charmed golden circle with their long hair and love beads, they'd get chased by men with spiky hair and big boots, you know, who then equated having long hair with homosexuality, in spite of the fact that these exotic creatures with long hair couldn't beat the totty off with a, you know, with a stick. It was really strange to say, well, he's got long hair, and he's getting all the girls. He must be a bit, you know, a bit of a teapot, you know what I mean? So we'll give him a kick in. And it was like that, and that was in London. It really wasn't that exotic. You did occasionally see men with long hair and bell bottoms. In fact, my dad said, here, I have half a crown, get on a bus to King's Road and go and have a laugh at the weirdos. Now, I used to think those weirdos were incredibly exotic. I thought, you know, wow, God, I wish I was like them.
Red apples hang like globes of light against this pale November haze. And now, although the mist is white, in half an hour, a day of days will climb into its golden height, and Sunday bells will ring its praise. The sparkling flint, the darkling yew, the red brick, less intensely red than hawthorn berries bright with dew, or leaves of creeper still unshed, the watery sky washed clear and new, are all rejoicing with the dead.
Up the ash tree climbs the ivy, up the ivy climbs the sun, leathery limbs of upper lambton shift the shade and make them run. Red apples hang like globes of light against this pale November haze, and now, although the mist is white, in half an hour a day of days will climb into its golden height, and Sunday bells will ring its praise.
Yeah, that's John Betjeman, Autumn 1964. I mean, I came across that quite by accident. I mean, I didn't really know much about John Betjeman. And a chap called Tony Stratton-Smith, who was Genesis's manager and one of the last real gentleman managers of pop, God rest his soul, a thoroughly good bloke, accidentally mailed me the entire collection of John Betjeman. He was meant to send me something else, and he told the secretary the wrong thing, and I got this stuff. I said, I've got some John Betjeman, Tony. He said, well, you like John Betjeman, don't you? And I said, yes, I love it, but I still need the demos so I can learn so-and-so. And he said, well, that's all right, hang on to them. So I did, and I started to listen to them, and it's got music by the great and very underestimated Jim Parker, who likes whimsical, almost Edwardian music around it, which is perfectly correct. And I got to like the music as well, and eventually met Jim Parker. I mean, we nearly got involved in a project together, and I said to him, you've actually met Sir John Betjeman? And he's quite, you know, he's a northern, very down-to-earth sort of bloke. He said, oh, yeah, I met him. And I said, what's he like? But, he wouldn't spill the beans. You know, he's a nice chap, but that was it. No matter how much I tried to get Jem to talk about the composing of his music, he wouldn't tell me much about it. And I'd lived with this music and John Betjeman's recordings for ages. And yet John Betjeman is vilified by one section of the poetry establishment and academia, who said, well, yes, all very well in his place. He's a teddy bear, a lovely, dear old Sir John. And the rest of the time they spent trying to uncover scurrilous things about his sex life, and or that he was running two women or something. And I'm just thinking, John Betjeman wrote the best modern English poetry I can think of. It rhymed, it scanned, it was about stuff. It's jolly evocative, It's great stuff, and everybody likes it. And I think here we have our problem. Everybody likes it, and academics don't. Because unless academia can hijack the thing and hold it up as some kind of arcane mystery, they don't like it, because it makes them look stupid. This thing about poets being mad, bad, and dangerous to know, he wasn't really. And I don't think Alfred Lord Tennyson, who was similarly prolific, he lived with one woman all his life, his missus, and apparently quite happily, and just wrote reams of stuff. Tons and tons of stuff. And a lot of poets do. It's not us poets who cause the problem. It's the it's them novelists and playwrights. They're the philanderers and the wife beaters and the serial, maniacs and drinkers and things. But John Betjeman poetry is really good. And again, he's done what I think all great artists should do. He has taken snapshots of the life that he saw and the England that he saw. He took very good snapshots and just said, this is what I see. He didn't say, this is some statement. He just said, this is what I see. What do you think? And I think that's what a good, graceful artist or writer should do. Take a snapshot or paint a portrait of what they see and then leave the rest. Don't assume that the reader or the listener is stupid. Just say, this is what I think I see. Do you reckon this is right? And if the public agree, then they will throw money. It isn't hearts and flowers that I remember, but the rose-hip bridges of September, a fading clip and clop of platform clogs, the frosty terraced streets and secret snogs, splintered benches where we used to meet, the windy ginnels, February sleet, the bus rides over hills to drab cafes in market towns on winter Saturdays, taking all account of push and shove, ours was not an ordinary love. And working for a living at 16, started young back then we did. I mean, they don't these days, it's not encouraged now. Growing up seemed sooner then, somehow. It isn't Valentine's though, I remember, but foggy evening lanes in late November. You in scoopnecks, me in baggy trousers, staring at the rich folk in their houses, plotting premium bond wins hand in glove. Ours was not an ordinary love. Not an ordinary time at that, your first driving lesson, my first flat. Three floors up, the bath, if you were willing, for a 1 hour wait and had a shilling. 70s, it doesn't seem that long. What was that old Paul McCartney song, Sea Moon, Close to Christmas? Do you recall arguing outside about it all? Tears, and then the making of it right. A far from ordinary night. And all the words I said I meant, and more, to hang around as wood smoke at your door. Till early spring, a promise on the breeze, the hazy green that ghosts across the trees. And fields waking up on days like these. Then later, with the outdoor work begun, you on a country station in the sun, waiting on a Friday for the train to bring your dusty boyfriend home again. Cheerful after drinking with the gov, ours was not an ordinary love. Both of us at work, hard work as such. 20s, you don't think about it much. Labourer and waitress of renown. Get stuck in, get paid and hit the town. Sod the others and their cold ambition. Were we not in love, we had a mission. Have a brilliant time before we lost it. Not sit down with Abacus to cost it. In event of judgment from above, ours was not an ordinary love. As I said, it wasn't hearts and flowers, rescuing Rapunzels from their towers, but an atmosphere of stolen hours. Idle shelter from those sudden showers. In museums, like paupers at a ball, staring at the grandness of it all. raincoat pockets, ticket stubs and tissues. In those carefree days were all our issues, shabby pigeon and his scruffy dove. Ours was not an ordinary love. Never big occasions, I remember, but the skint nights in around December. One bar of a 3-bar gas fire hissing, lovers on an indoor sunbreak kissing, kitchen trips for optional excursions, making tea or switching on immersions, caught by tipsy test card unawares, squaring to the challenge of the stairs after taking stock of their location. Ours was not an average situation. Pop star posters peeling on the wall. That's what I remember most of all, in the kitchen making homemade wine. Quite forgot about the Valentine. You due home in minutes from your shift. Had to knot one up, and rather swift. Cardboard, paper, scissors and the glue. Here's new wave Valentine for you. Blackmail typeface from a velvet glove. Ours was not an ordinary love. We never did the jet set stuff, not us. We opted for the railway or the bus, over autumn moorlands to the sea, round the ruined castle and some tea. Backstreet book exchanges, then a beer. Ironstone gorges, waterfall and weir. Beaches out of season, groins and dunes. Marram grass and sandy afternoons. Westerlies to give the clouds a shove. Ours was not an ordinary love. Not the trifling trinkets that I bought you, but the courage which it took to court you, having saddled up and got that far. Was I not your co-op Lochinvar? You, my happy shopper, queen of Sheba, hair by Icarus and eyes by Bieber, Aramis for you, Kikyu for you. Fragrant then, if nothing else, we two, wrapped around each other when as supple. This was not an ordinary couple. This was not an ordinary caper, and it never made the local paper. In the pics, we never looked our parts. Can we have you holding up your hearts? We never had the attitude or look. We never made the film or wrote the book. We never got our music on the shelves, and only ever famous to ourselves. We both became recluses, didn't care. We were not an ordinary pair. Now, if you find crow's feet round your eyes, or some piffling ounces on your thighs, and the hint of puckering round your lips, God forbid a pound upon your hips, not to ever notice is my game, telling you you've always looked the same, or ignoring everything you've said, pleading urgent business in my shed, since I'll only see the things I can. Am I not an ordinary man? Should the winter ambush with no warning, let me set your grace up in the morning. Let me get your breakfast, make you coffee, fetch bad weather brandy from the offie, be your grey-fries Bobby who would wait even if the reaper made you late. Challenge him for you, and if I find him, follow down the corridor behind him, raging with the insults I would hurl. This was not an ordinary girl. Time has dragged the sentiment from in me. Fear of losing you will underpin me. So in lieu of others in the past then, let this be my Valentine at last then. Up the wooden hills again and gladly, let them know we didn't do too badly. When we went from darkness into light, ours was not an ordinary flight. You are not an ordinary dove. Ours is not an ordinary love. High Llamas with Over the River from the Cold and Bouncy album. Sean O'Hagan is a Corksman. They are Irishmen. They live in London, or they did live in London. And the thing that Sean O'Hagan, it's the leader of the band, has been most widely noted for doing is having a complete infatuation with Brian Wilson's music, post Pet Sounds music, which I think is a little unfair because I think Sean O'Hagan has quite a lot of his own music in there for a start. There is a little bit of Henry Mancini in there. There's American music in general. I mean, that track, Over the River, actually reminds me of one of those 60s series where a guy's walking down the street, he's just finished work, it's an American TV series, and he's just saying, "Hi, honey, I'm home," or "Home, honey, I'm high," as I say. You know, and it's a kind of music. Hanna-Barbera did a cartoon series like The Flintstones, and it was set in the future, and it was called The Jetsons. And George Jetson would come home, you know, and he'd have this dog called Astro. And I imagine this would be the kind of music that George Jetson would listen to. It's got those strange electronic blips and whirs and wibble. And that's kind of what makes it. Otherwise, it would be, you know, a bit more ordinary. But it's not, because when you play it to someone who just likes conventional music, And, you know, if I played it, for instance, to a group of my parents' friends, they think, oh, great, you know, very pleasant music, nice sunny days music. And then all the time underneath it, there's this kind of... which anyone who's, you know, grown up in a post-psychedelic culture immediately identifies with and understands. And a whole bunch of people who stopped listening around about 1955 didn't, you know, and wouldn't. So they think, well, you know, as I said, what are we listening to, Martin? I'm saying, oh, it's the High Llamas. They do, you know, what we call loungecore music. And I love it. I've got nothing but good memories about that track. Real sunny day stuff. That was Captain Sensible from his first LP, solo LP, Women and Captains First, and his guest, the Beale Street Jazz Band, who I think came from Croydon, a typical trad band, a very good one. My dad used to listen to a bit of trad. And at one point, John Cooper Clarke, another poet, and I used to have a running joke about trad. I go around saying trad's not dead and noting which trad bands were playing in the area, because it always seemed to go with guys with very bushy beards and sandals and those peculiar tapestry waistcoats that they wear. I don't know where they get them from, but they all get them, and they sit around, you know, drinking real ale. And I said, it's the sound, trad is the sound of men being flatulent at both ends, you know, it's like, brah! And there's always a call and response, you know, as they sing in that last track. And you walk down the avenue. There was a track that Bonzo Dog Doodle Band did called Jazz Delicious Hot Disgusting Cold, and we'd stand there going Because that's how a lot of the tracks end. The funny thing about trad, unlike modern jazz, is that, you know, because you're a rock and roller, you look at jazz is funny, whatever, you know. I've become a jazz fan subsequently, but when you first see it, it's just, oh yes, it's jazz, it's all a bit clever. And there's, when it comes up in trad, everyone takes a solo at the same time, so there's incredible racket going on. And unless a trad band really knows what they're doing, they're not counterpointing, they're just making a racket. You've just got these 5 or 6 really drunk men standing up on stage going, and then there's a bunch of equally drunk men and women sort of driving around down the front or standing down, you know, on a key somewhere. It's always jazz, you know. You can't have rock and roll in any of the pubs in England, or there's always a problem. But if you just say it's pints of real ale and jazz, that somehow makes it all right. They park them outside on a quayside or out on a village green in the middle of summer. And they make this unholy racket if they're not any good. And everyone comes out and taps their feet because it's somehow all right. And there's men in the audience who used to play in trad bands all kind of go, yah, yah, yah. You know, there's a big trad boom in England in the early 60s before the Beatles came. But kind of trad is very, very good sunny days English music. Lots of people really like it. And I think Captain definitely tapped into that, but I would not have thought of doing a trad track. I mean, he's a punk star. He's generally thought of and kind of slightly derided, or has been over years, for doing The Man Who Did Happy Talk, which was a joke track he bunged on a solo album. As a present for his dad, who liked South Pacific, but somebody released it in the silly season in summer, it shot to the top. And everybody kind of forgot that he was one of the founding fathers of punk rock. You know, there was a triumvirate of the Sex Pistols, the Clash and the Damned. And the Damned were first with everything, first with a single, an LP and an American tour. And they've kind of been airbrushed out because the middle class revisionists who wrote about punk, and I'm naming no names, just had an idea of what they thought punk ought to have been, and the Damned kind of didn't fit the mode, because the Damned were genuinely what punk purported to be. They were a bunch of hooligans who happened to be able to play their instruments very well indeed, and it was very inconvenient. Captain had played in a cabaret band briefly. He'd done all, if you're a musician, you play, you play everyone. Ratscape was a really, really good drummer. The whole band was great. I mean, I think it was only Dave Vanian who hadn't really done it before, but he was a fan. And then Captain Sensible is a most, you know, I was waiting for him to turn up somewhere, and a manager said, where is he? Because he is, you know, an assassin of punctuality, as Ian Dury would say. And he was off at the Barbican seeing a quartet doing some Vaughan Williams stuff. I mean, he knows his music. This is a guy who knows music and who can compose it. And he's just thought of, yeah, typically. Oh, well, that's the guy who did Happy Talk. I've seen Roland Riveron, who briefly had a chat show. Said, oh, you know, happy talking, happy talk. Like he's some kind of a joke. I know he's called Captain Sensible. He's actually an extremely good musician and a much admired guitarist. It really doesn't pay off being British sometimes.
And I've run out of pale ale, and I feel like I'm in jail, and my music bores me once again. And I've been on the pinball, and I no longer know it all. And they say that you never know when you're insane. Got fleas in the bedroom, got flies in the bathroom, and the cat just finished off the bread. So I walk over Soho, and I read about Monroe, and I wonder was she really what they said. Got a call from a good friend, come on down for the weekend. Didn't know if I could spare the time. I knew a woman who was crazy about a boy who was lazy, but it didn't work out 'cause they just couldn't make it rhyme. We're all right. I could have grooved with you all night, but you turned your back on the party game. Yeah.
That was Brian Prothero with a song called Pinball, which was a hit in the English charts, at least, in 1974, in about October. I remember it as a kind of soundtrack of the autumn for me, because the thing that was glam rock had just about gone off the boil by then, and I was playing in a pop group and washing up dishes in the day and playing in a pop group at night in Colchester, and, you know, definitely glam rock was over. And that, not that that was anything to do with glam rock, but it was a really good song in a, in an ocean of otherwise not particularly good songs in the charts. And Brian Prothero was in fact an actor. You would see him in various things, or his name would come up, and he made this great record. And I think he made an LP of the same name. And I subsequently saw his name come up occasionally. I don't look him up on the internet or anything like that, so I don't know what he's doing at the moment. But it was certainly a fantastic pop record, a lot better than a lot of professional pop musicians were making. Beautifully produced, very evocative, kind of Beatley. For me, it was a standard of excellence, which in songwriting, and reminded me of that autumn of 1974, in just when things had gone off the boil, kind of melancholy. You knew you weren't going to get another Beatles, but they weren't going to play the Pink Fairies or Alex Harvey on the radio. You have to understand that BBC was then presided over by a peculiar mixture of, you know, kind of celebrity gentlemen farmers. I don't know if it would be very graceful to name their names, because there was this Night of the Long Knives during which many of them were got rid of. But it was really strange. These, you know, middle-aged men with middle-aged voices, completely not in touch with pop. And if they ever found anything that was halfway decent, they resolutely went out and didn't play it. All of us used to depend on the radio. And what happened in the afternoon was that they just saw fit to weld Radio 1 and Radio 2 together, and we'd have 3 hours of Diddy David Hamilton talking to housewives and playing as the most unimaginable load of old tripe. And out of rebellion, we would tune the radio to Radio Caroline, which had begun broadcasting. Only they began broadcasting at 6 o'clock. So in the afternoon, when we were scrubbing the kitchen clean and cleaning out the fridge and degreasing the fan, what industrial cleaners did, we would listen, just rather than listen to what was being foisted on us by Radio 1 and 2 hybrid, we listened to a Dutch station called Mi Amigo. This is your office, this is your
office. Good morning, Radio Mi Amigo.
Goedemorgen iedereen, goedemorgen Albert. Ik moet wel zeggen dat ik over het algemeen nogal zeeziek word, maar ik moet zeggen dat me hier opvalt.
I could even sing you some of the jingles in Dutch. And the LPs, there was one, 14 hits on ANLP, P, met the hollies, met the cream. There was another one for a dust bug that went, and Dardor Trickendor, and Dardor Trickendor, is spread on the flatten from Aiden Tank. And it would just sound like that. You know what the hell it meant. And we heard all sorts of weird continental records and Dutch hits. And someone would say, why don't you turn to Radio 1? And, you know, and someone new porter would come in and say, why don't we turn to Radio 1? And we'd just turn around the old hardened kitchen hands and go, are you king joking? Why would we want to listen to that? And I'm sure that Radio 1, who, you know, the gentleman farmers who ran it, would be appalled if they'd known how the real youth were thinking. But all I remember is nobody listened to the BBC at that point. We all just listened to, you know, anything, foreign stations. They'd never got it so wrong as in the mid-70s. And it was reflected in a kind of complete trough of music, which eventually led to punk rock being invented. People just stopped listening to what the record companies and the radio stations were offering. And they invented their own music. And jolly good thing it was too. One of the more curious things about that musical Dead Man's Gulch between glam rock and punk rock was that Radio Caroline started running a series of jingles for a thing called Loving Awareness. And they'd have these echoey voices going, Loving Awareness, you may not know what it is. And we thought, great, you know, let us know where we can go out and buy it, or can we send an envelope for it? You know, could I get an envelope of it or something like that? Or do you score it on the street? But at that time, they launched a band called the Loving Awareness Band. Ronan O'Reilly, who was the controller, the notable eccentric, who kind of kept the whole thing going, and got it sparked up again later, got these session musicians and asked them to do an album about Loving Awareness, and they plugged it relentlessly. The album was played to death. kind of got used to the album. Some of it was obviously good music. We thought, oh, they're session musicians, which they probably were. But you got to eventually like some of the stuff because you did hear it a lot. You thought, well, it's not actually that bad. Well, the way the Loving Awareness Band came about, I understand, was Ronan O'Reilly, you know, the noted eccentric, the main man at Radio Caroline, wanted to promote the idea of Loving Awareness. So Ronan O'Reilly employed a young guy called Mike Hagler, a young DJ, and just said to him, can you promote Loving Awareness? And kind of subcontracted the job out, and somehow these four session musicians were found, and that's Mike Hagler just found himself with this job on his hand. I mean, how would you do it?
Are you suffering from the aches and pains of a routine life of DA? Do problems and frustrations hem you into a pattern of self-destruction and negativity toward yourself and others around you? Life doesn't have to be a prison. Let LA prove it to you.
Let me take you through your sadness. Face the things you cannot leave. Let a sense of purpose fill your heart, let your soul begin to speak.
An age-old and time-tested remedy, L.A. will take you out of your rut and put you back into the mainstream of humanity at absolutely no cost to you.
All the burdens you have carried, Lord, know they're gonna be free. Know they're gonna be free.
So stop making sacrifices to DA and get into the LA habit and begin to benefit from the happy difference. Everyone will love you for it.
We'll get by, though the tears and the sighs will be trying to break us apart. If you got love,
if you got love,
you got love,
you got love,
if you got love, you got love.
The band really that stole it for me were Ian Dury's band, The Blockheads. They were bloody great. I mean, Norman Watroy is a fantastic bass player, of whom the late Alex Harvey was once, when he saw Norman Watroy, he just said, you know, in his thick Glaswegian, I'd kill for a bass player like that. You know, he was a sensational bass player. And they were so tight, but they weren't really punk, but they fitted in with it really well. And I heard Ian Dury doing My Old Man, and everything about The Blockheads resonated. I went and saw them on something, they stiff tour hit town or something, like a Wednesday or Thursday night. And the next day, as soon as I'd finished washing up, and before I went off to rehearsal, I went and bought the album. I went into a record shop, and I brought it home to the people I lived with, you know, a crowd of people I lived with, and they said, what's this? And I said, listen to this, it's great. My Old Man was a favourite one, because it's about his dad who was drove a bus for London Transport, and my granddad was a bus driver, so I identify with that, and he almost yawns the track when you listen to it. It's almost like he's yawning, kind of, my old man, like, you know, like he's just woken up, like a boy woken up from a dream. And I met him once when my girlfriend at the time was away. She used to sell earrings. They were kind of feathered looking creations at the time. You made them out of feathers. They were feathers and wire and bindings and beads. And because I knew the tricks of the trade, I went down there. She said, see if you can make me some money while I'm away in Greece, making love to foreigners, which is probably what she was doing. I like to think so. And I got a whole load of earrings. I'll make her some money while she's away. So I got a load of earrings, put on a kind of black suit, and went down there and he was sort of going, hey, do you want to buy some earrings? And I blacked my hair to Ian Dury's dressing room. And he was only a little geezer, you know. I didn't realise he was that small, because everyone looks big on stage, don't they? And I got up to the dressing room, and finally Ian Dury comes to the door, and I thought, God, I've only bloody done it. Because the security was quite tight. They had Spider Rowe, that bald geezer who used to look after him, and all kinds of people guarding him, because he was only a little chap, and it was punk times, and it was just beginning to get a bit rough at gigs. And I actually made it through like I was urgent, like I had to be, oh, let me through. He said, have you got a part? No, Ian will see me, you know, blah, blah, blah. I've seen such and such, like, there was someone I knew up there. Just tell me it'll be all right, you know. And I got up there and knocked on the door, and Ian Jury, and he says, yes, and I said, I said, I've got some earrings. My girlfriend makes them. And I said, I've come here to sell some because she needs some money when she hitches back from Greece. And I just figured, you were an earring kind of guy. And I noticed he was wearing a razor blade earring in his ear. And he looked at him and he said, it's very nice. And then he said, nah, he said, not my type of thing, old cock.
Whistles, he was never home for long. Drove a bus for London Transport, he knew where he belonged. Number 18 down to Euston, double decker, move along, double decker, move along. My old man, later on he drove a roller, chauffeuring for foreign men. Dropped his H's on occasion, said go blimey now and then. Did the crossword in the Standard, at the airport in the rain, at the airport in the rain. My old man wouldn't ever let his governors call him Billy, he was proud. Personal reasons make a difference, his last bus was allowed. Perhaps he had to keep his distance, made a racket when he round, made a racket when he round. My old man, my old man. My old man was fairly handsome, he smoked too many cigs. Lived in one room in Victoria, he was tidy in his digs. Had to have an operation when his ulcer got too big, when his ulcer got too big. My old man. Had begun. All the while we thought about each other. All the best, mate, from your son. All the best, mate, from your son. My